Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 293 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Becca Heddle speaks with Jane Draycott about discovering traditional African dilemma tales, the psychological dimensions of cloning in her new young adult novel, and the continuing need for bold fiction writing for younger readers.
Books and childhood belong very much together in the work of Becca Heddle, the writer for young adults and children, who says she spent most of her own childhood in the library at the end of her road. I'm here with Becca at her home just outside Oxford to find out about what it's like to have titles covering topics as wide-ranging as the habitats of otters and the history of communications technology, jostling for space in your imagination with the retelling of traditional tales and a speculative novel about a teenager trying to break free from mind control and find a place in the world. Becca, among the awards and nominations for your writing, your book Science with Weather won the Junior Copus Prize for its contribution to the public understanding of science, and your young adult novel A Body was nominated for the Bath Children's Novel of 2018. Now, they sound like very different pieces of writing, very different pieces of work. So how did each of those rather different strands in your writing begin?
Starting with the writing for younger readers, which is the vast majority of my output, that came about because when I left university, I didn't know what to do with myself. And I walked down the street in Oxford and went into each of the bookshops and asked if they had any jobs. The one I really wanted was to work at Blackwell's Children's Bookshop, and that's where I got a job. I spent my 6 months there reading most of the stock and became very aware of children's publishing and how it worked, so that when I saw an advert for Usborne advertising for editorial staff, I jumped at the chance. And then moved on to other editorial work at Oxford University Press, where I was on the same corridor as the primary literacy team and got to know various of that team.
And that led into what sounds like quite a long career in writing for school-aged children. Am I right?
That's right, yes. When I first went freelance from OUP, I was trying to get back to writing, having done almost exclusively editing while I was there. And on one very opportune occasion, going in with my brand new baby and meeting someone who was about to start commissioning a new non-fiction strand, I managed to build it up from that start. It's really fun because I'm an intellectual magpie. I love finding out about new stuff, and it's the perfect excuse.
And the perfect reader, I'd have thought. Do you have a sense of your readers, your young readers, when you're working on that kind of book?
You're guided very strongly in writing educational readers because you are pegged to not only a word count, often subjects, because you need to be guided by what's being hit in the national curriculum at a particular age group, but also by the actual language that you can use, the words you can use, right down to the very sounds you can use if you're in a series which is governed by phonics, which, particularly at the lowest levels, they all are. So that guides you to a very great extent. But I think there's also a temperamental thing of if you get excited by new stuff, then that helps a lot.
Wonderful, yes. And in the retelling of traditional tales, which I think you were involved in as well, or you've done over time, is there more scope there for the writer in you?
I think often it's in the selection of the tales as much as how you tell them. Often they're looking for things which are slightly different. So, for example, my absolute knockout bestseller so far is a Japanese story retelling called Yoshi the Stonecutter, which is about... It's sort of like one of those Three Wishes stories, but it's a sequence of wishes. This guy is a stonecutter. He really wishes that he could be better off, and there's a spirit in the mountains that grants his wishes. He never sees it. And he gradually progresses, getting socially more important. But at each point, he realises that there's something still missing, until eventually it comes full circle and he decides just to be a stonecutter again. But finding stories that haven't been told lots and lots of times is quite important. In another book that I worked on, I had to produce, I think I had to come up with three different stories which ideally involved dilemmas or big decisions. And all of those, in the end, came up with a female focus, which was nice because so many traditional stories are very male-focused. And that exposed me to another completely different sort of story, which I had not known about at all. The African Dilemma Tales, which are very, very short stories, very bare-bones stories, which don't have the structure of a story that we would recognise from European traditional tales. They simply pose an almost impossible situation and leave you there. So three people each contribute to a solution to a problem. They've apparently each contributed equally. Which one should get the big reward? And the whole point of these stories is not to be a satisfying story with an ending, but promote a fantastic discussion.
That does sound so very different.
Absolutely.
A lot of European, Central European fables and moral tales. And,
yeah.
And working on those tales for children, did that in any way, or does that in any way relate to your own original writing for young writers?
I think it is different tracks in my mind, although, you know what, our brains and personalities are like. Nothing is ever wasted, is it? There's always something that you could probably look at and go, oh, yeah, I got that from there. So I'm not aware of a great crossover between the two strands that I'm dabbling in, but...
And you're more than dabbling. I mean, your novel, A Body, about a teenager, was nominated for the Bath Children's Novel of 2018. And it's a speculative novel about an imagined future, a teenager in an imagined future. How did that begin?
Well, when I was living in the library at the bottom of the road, so to speak, I read just about everything I could lay my hands on. And my mum was quite a science fiction fan. She said, oh, it's fairy stories for grown-ups. And when I went to university, I joined the speculative fiction group, which meant that I read a lot more science fiction and fantasy and spent a fantastically productive time discussing books with people from very different intellectual backgrounds to my own. So we'd have these brilliant conversations where I would get taught about relativity. And they would rave about the ideas in books, and I would quite often have reservations if I didn't feel that the ideas were explored with convincing characters.
So when you're writing this, for instance, when you were writing this, was character what drove it for you?
Absolutely, yes. Completely character-driven. In fact, the idea for the book came from a conversation I had with someone in that speculative fiction group years ago, but was revived by watching the first series of the Channel 4 series Humans, which was about androids and consciousness. And the whole idea of being a fully grown person coming to self-awareness at that point in your life just kind of nagged at me and reminded me of this conversation that we'd had years before where we'd discussed the possible personality and ethical dimensions of cloning. If you cloned a replacement body to move into when your own one was worn out, what would happen to the person in the cloned body? I asked. His view was that, well, it would be the same as me. It would have no possible objection. It would see things the same way I do. I wasn't very convinced about this. And I suppose that stayed in the back of my mind until it came out in the idea of this character. I had to think rather perverted thoughts about how you would raise someone to try and create a blank slate person in order to convince yourself that this could be the case. But that was very much in the background. Writing it, I had very much to try to immerse myself in her world, what she would know, what she wouldn't know, in order to then follow her journey and find out what happened to her.
And how old is your protagonist?
She's actually 15, although I can imagine I will have some difficulty with that, as I think the book in general is aimed at older YA readers, and traditionally people don't like to read stories about people younger than themselves or about the same age as themselves. They prefer to read stories about people a little bit older than them, if they're kids.
Oh, that's fascinating.
My main reason for making her that age was that that's the point at which, generally, the female growth curve has bottomed out. At that point, you have a mature body, so that's the crisis point for her in her story.
And so that's your scientific understanding there. But you're also a mother of teenage girls. Does some of that find its way in here as well, your interest in this 15-year-old or your creation of a girl protagonist, do you think?
Probably. I think I chose to write about a girl because I know them from the inside. I was one. And I have two teenage daughters, as you say. But I don't know whether I've thought very consciously about them and how they work.
And so when you're writing those two very different kinds of books, how does your imaginative self approach them very differently?
That's a good question. Of course, I've also written a few stories of my own for the reading schemes, which, again, although those are also governed by the same rules as the traditional tales, as the non-fiction I write, but that is a bit more freewheeling, and it's something that I've found quite challenging, because I've got very used to writing non-fiction. I know what I'm doing with that. Writing something from your own imagination and not at anybody else's behest is a lot more challenging because, oh, to be honest, I've got a ridiculous Protestant work ethic. There's this general feeling of, this is probably the most enormous waste of time. And you're very aware that quite possibly nobody but you will ever read it. So I think it is much harder to then persuade yourself that it's worth pushing through the procrastination, the fear of failure and all of those things to actually do it.
And what did you read and enjoy as a child?
Oh, well, just about everything I could get. I read a lot of what was around in the house. So a lot of post-war fiction, just post-war, and things that were older than that. So I remember cutting my teeth on What Katie Did, and Heidi, Anne of Green Gables, and books by Malcolm Savile that my mother had had. I'm probably getting a rather weird worldview from that. I never seemed to be worried by the fact that it didn't represent the world that I lived in, but I liked the adventure.
And a lot of female characters in those?
Quite a lot of female characters in those, definitely. One of my favourites that I reread again and again from about the age of eight was Thursday's Child by Noel Stretfield, which is a fantastic rip-roaring adventure with a gutsy, fibbing heroine who was everything that I would in some ways have liked to be. She was very brave, and it had scenes of climbing out of orphanage windows and down trees in order to go and do things, always with a good purpose behind them. She was never naughty for the sake of being naughty. She was very self-driven. She had a massive sense of moral outrage at the way that she and the other orphans were being treated. And I think I admired her so much because of that spirit. So there was something very, very attractive about this character. But again, it is the character. Yeah.
So is there something of that character in Dill, your heroine, your protagonist? Do you admire her?
I think I do. I think I would find it hard to write from the point of view of a character who I didn't like. And while her world is bewildering to her, particularly as she becomes aware of a world other than the one she's been brought up in, because her world has been so tightly controlled, she hasn't even been able to ask questions about anything. So that whole idea of growing and questioning and coming to be a self-driving person, I found very interesting.
So even beyond the futuristic invention, is there something in that character which is about growing up?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. Because growing up is about finding your place in the world. It's about working out who you are and how you fit and this character has to do that basically from scratch. She has to work out at the end of the day whether she can actually be a person. Is she a person? Can she function in the world outside her, which is basically the world now? It's more an alternative now than a kind of a future. So, yes, I suppose in many ways that's what it is about. I expect a lot of YA fiction is about exactly that.
Who are the YA writers who you're interested in or who you admire?
Oh, probably the one I love the best is Patrick Ness, because his writing is just astonishing. There's a very strong focus on character. He writes very clearly and in a fairly spare style. It's not very fancy. He's the, to me, a gold standard of YA writing. I get a bit frustrated with some of the books that I read where everything is so driven by the need to have pace and conflict and running around that questions of character and motivation sometimes get left behind. But possibly that's just because that's not what really appeals to me as a reader. And I think we always want to write the sort of thing that we love to read the best.
I know I've heard writers for children and young adults say that their writing partly involves, for them as writers, getting back in touch with their younger selves. I mean, is that something you've experienced or recognised?
To a degree, but I think the world has changed a lot since I was a young reader delving into the library at the end of my road. The books that I read as a child were very much subject to the views of the time. A strong, feisty female character was all very well, but nonetheless there was this general backdrop of what it was, how it was acceptable to be female. And the default positions have been very strongly challenged more recently, and I think that's absolutely right. So if I were to write from the point of view of who I was as a child, I think it would be very disappointing to a modern readership. In the reading scheme books that I work on, quite often when I'm editing or working on teaching materials, I can be quite frustrated by there still being a current of, if there are two characters in a story and one is male and one is female, the one who has the permission to accept that they are scared or that something is lovely tends to be the female character. And that's limiting for both of them. I think it's easier for girl characters to be strong than it is for boy characters to be, in inverted commas, weak, because there is no weakness in emotion. It's troubling. And that bothers me.
Maybe you could say you've described your reading habits over all these years and you're reading YA fiction and you've been interested all this time in science fiction and speculative fiction. Why are you interested in that mode of writing about alternative realities, alternative possibilities for young protagonists, do you think?
I don't know whether it's because there's a sense of things opening up, of exploration about it. I think that's why the speculative genre is interesting, because it's rarely about the idea. It's more about what it tells you about people. So, for example, I'm also a big fan of Margaret Atwood, Ursula Le Guin, hugely, whose work is probably not YA, but you could kind of, you know, and I know Atwood stresses that she's not a writer of speculative fiction, but I would argue, as many would, that quite a lot of hers fits into that area. I suppose it's the biggest way of asking what if, isn't it? And what if is always a propelling question for a writer and for a reader.
I know you work in classrooms, or you have worked in classrooms, in school classrooms. Do you have a sense of what makes the kind of book that they are most attracted by?
There are all the perennial interests. Dinosaurs. People used to say you should only really write books for children about things that relate to their world. And dinosaurs is the fantastic antithesis of that. It's the proof that that can't be the case. Kids are fascinated by dinosaurs, and there's absolutely no way they relate to their current world. But the big thing that I think they do love, and which I'm completely incapable of, is humorous writing. And there's obviously been a big boom in that recently with things like the Roald Dahl Funny Prize. There's a lot of particularly what they call middle grade fiction, which is very humorous. And I wish I could do that. I wish I could be funny on purpose. But
And think about Roald Dahl. There's a lot of humour. There's quite a lot of darkness in it too.
Absolutely. And this might be heretical, but I'm not a huge fan of Roald Dahl. But you're right, there's a definite darkness there. And certainly when reading some of his books to my children when they were small, I had to take on a very flat reading style in order not to completely freak them out with some bits of it.
Oh, yes. And there's darkness too in a lot of traditional tales.
Oh, that's for sure, yes. Original versions of Cinderella have the ugly sisters chopping their toes off, don't they, to get into their shoes. I think we expect children to be able to cope with less than they can. I think we're very aware that the world can be a dark and an unsettling place. But I'm not entirely sure that children can be prepared for that by being given books where there is nothing dark and unsettling about them. I'm aware, though, that there's the whole business of children's books aren't actually sold to children. They, for the vast majority, don't get to choose what books they read. The books always have to go through gatekeepers. It's teachers and parents who generally buy the books that children read. And that does mean that there's a deal of filtering going on there. But I think from the 80s and onwards, the current of real stories brought about by writers like Jacqueline Wilson, with their focus on contemporary real life, representing the sort of people who wouldn't necessarily expect to see themselves in a book. That was fantastic. And I think that still continues with bolder writers. So there is a concern, though, that if we take out too much of the complicated, the messy, the slightly disturbing, that children end up reading a very flat world, which can't be great. You do see that in YA, that there's an introduction of rather more scary things. There's been a big boom in recent years in dystopian fiction, as well as supernatural stuff and what have you. Whereas when I'm writing books for reading schemes, there is an absolute ban on anything supernatural, really. I mean, you could have a monster in a book, as long as it's clearly quite harmless, but no witches or things like that. And that's largely because these books are published across a wide variety of cultures, and there are some which won't want those books. It's very restricted, and I can understand that. And that's not about the darkness necessarily, is it? It's about other things. But also there's the fear of litigation. You can't show children putting their heads out of train windows, because, you know, what if a child, having read your book, put their head out of train window? But then I think in any kind of writing books for children, you are probably more aware of that. You wouldn't have the famous five just wandering off and doing their own thing these days. It just couldn't happen.
What a shame.
It is, yeah. So, and I wonder whether that's why magic has come in so much, because if you're in the context of a world where there is magic, you can go off and have your adventure, you can steal the flying car and fly to school, because you know that can't happen. So it's safe. I'm not sure. Although there's definitely still a current of get the parents out of the way.
Get the parents out of the way.
Yeah. And the vast majority of children's stories start with there being no parents around. You look back at Thursday's Child, Orphans, and almost all of Roald Dahl's stories get the parents out of the way. The child gets taken off on an adventure where the parents can't come, or they've been, in the case of James and the Giant Peach, destroyed by a rogue rhino or hippo, I can't remember. And also enables them to then be in charge of their decisions. They're the driver of their fate, because they're not being supervised in that way. So it's,
this is the next generation.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why Jacqueline Wilson is very necessary, and other writers who deal with refugee stories or other ways of, I mean, Patrick Ness, of course, is great because he has a lot of gay characters, and so there's that whole sort of recognising and celebrating the whole diversity of experience and saying, well, you know, it can be whoever and however you are.
Thank you, Becca. That's been absolutely fascinating, a fascinating subject. And thank you for talking so generously about it.
Thank you.
That was Becca Heddle in conversation with Jane Draycott. You can find out more about Becca on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 293, which was recorded and produced by Jane Draycott. Coming up in episode 294, in another instalment of our Location and the Writer series, Horatio Clare takes us to poet-haunted Hebden Bridge, Lucy Moore celebrates London by pedal, and Curtis Jobling reimagines phantoms in Great Sankey. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.